August 17th, 2020. My Gracie went off to school today, first day of 8th grade. She was pumped. Just like my other two 8th grade graduates, Grace brought her notebooks, her folders, her binders, her Clorox wipes, and her hand sanitizers. Today's guest is John Craddock. You might know him better as Frank Opinion. Before we start, thanks to John Hadley for letting us set this up in the 590 Studios. Great audio quality on this one without Zoom. Frank does not do many of these. Thanks to my old college roommate, Tim Woodburn, co-host on Frank's show. He helped set this up. We got great stories. We talked Grady, Ed Etorial, how he almost replaced Jack Carney. More on that later. Blues squeaked one out last night. Puck drops tonight down 2-1 versus Vancouver. Trump is going to blame the post office if he loses. Either way, don't wait. Again, either way, mail in those ballots before October 20th. Three things you should if you have not. Uncle Bill's on Manchester opened up last week. Welcome back, old friend. If you don't want to wait, if you don't go inside, dial it up. 636-394-1416. 636-394-1416. Chicken fried steak, hash browns, and pancakes can never go wrong with the omelets. We also went corned beef hash, crisped to perfection. Number two. Next time you're on Facebook, look up St. Louis Media History. Look, I don't have a dog in this fight. It's a free plug, kind of like what I just did with Uncle Bill's. What an archive of past old print ads, pictures of media folks, and they seem to add something every week. No shock here, I'm a fan. So, if you like this episode, you might want to check out previous chats we've had with folks like Guy Phillips, Randy Carricker, J.C. Corcoran. If you want to make sure you don't miss upcoming conversations, just click subscribe on the screen where you're listening to this. Won't spam you, promise, what good would that do me? You can also subscribe on our YouTube channel where you can see Frank's St. Louis 7 and find out what his favorite concert is. All previous St. Louis 7s are there. YouTube channel, OT with Oliver. So, Frank Opinion. Here's what I've always liked about John Frank. He never apologizes for what he is. Not that he has to, I'm just saying he's authentic, confident, and appreciative of his audience. Nobody tells a story better, and the story he tells about advertisers, to me, is a radio Hall of Famer, like him. As Frank might say, nothing special about this one. I would disagree.
Go to Overtime. Overtime with Oliver, with my dad. Tell your friends.
So what we typically do, if it's all right with you, do like about a 45-minute interview or so. You don't like the phrase, but just document. It's kind of what, you know, the podcast itself, about 5 months ago we started. And I just wanted one place where people could go to find out about important people, places, and events in St. Louis.
Okay.
And so a lot of it, because of the radio background that I've got, you know, have been guys I used to work with, okay, some TV guys. I'm most excited probably after your interview with some folks that built the Arch.
So good, I'm sorry.
That's okay. So in an effort to start somewhere, I want to thank you for your time. I know that you don't do a lot of these things, so let's sit back and have some fun. Long way from Humboldt, Tennessee.
Humboldt.
Yeah.
You don't have any say in where you're born, because if I did, I would never have picked that place. It's a hillbilly West Tennessee town of just southern country people. And probably the best thing that ever happened to me was when my dad had to leave, not Humboldt, but Savannah. When we were seven, I moved to Savannah, which is an equally depressing, hillbilly, nothing town. And he needed a job. He had a job, but he was miserable working for his brother. So he just started searching and ended up working for a publishing company in St. Louis on, I think, Jefferson. He was a compositor, meaning back when there was metal type and ink, he would compose the pages for magazines, or he was a laborer. He would put metal type in and put it together on a page, and then they'd ink it and print it. And that's what he did. That's what he did in Tennessee for his brother at a newspaper. And again, probably the best thing that ever happened to me was when I was forced to be plucked out of that go nowhere backwards hick town and be thrown into a very uncomfortable environment of Yankees, which is what we call people in this part of the country. And it's only, you know, 275 miles north, but people here are Yankees to the people in Tennessee. So, yeah, long way from Humboldt, Tennessee. Thank goodness.
Was there a preacher in your family?
Yes.
Wrote a lot of books?
Yes.
Did you learn how to storytell from him?
I hardly knew him. I'd see him as a kid twice a year because he was my dad's brother, but he was a very well-known, not only preacher, but it was either Newsweek or U.S. News and World Report, I think it was called, did an article, I don't know, the 80s, I guess, about the, like the 10 greatest preachers in the United States. And he was listed as one of the 10 best. Billy Graham was up there, of course. And he was listed not just because of his preaching, but he was a teacher. He taught in at Emory University theology. So he was real smart. And apparently, and I'd heard him preach, a good storyteller. So I don't know that I got it. You never know what you get, whatever you have. You don't know where it came from. You know, my dad's other brother, he had two other brothers, owned a newspaper that my dad, that's where my dad worked for him. And he was the owner, editor, publisher, and he wrote an editorial column and then a kind of a fun gossip column every week. So he was a storyteller. But my dad never said 1,000 words my whole life. We never had a real conversation. He was, the word introvert would be an understatement. He didn't talk.
What about your mom?
She talked too much. Yeah, talked too much. Yeah, she was the opposite. She controlled everything, including him. So, yeah, she was a talker. But I don't know. You get little bits and pieces of whatever you are, whoever you are, right, from who knows where.
Went to high school in Waterloo?
Went to high school in Waterloo the last 2 years. When we moved up here, I was 15. And I was the only new kid in school, and I think maybe the only new kid they'd ever seen for 10 years, the way they acted. Waterloo is a real close-knit German community, and all the other kids in school, they knew each other because they'd all grown up from kindergarten on with each other, kindergarten, grade school. So they all knew each other, and then here I came, a Southern kid with a bad, bad accent. I mean a bad one, just like this, exactly how I sounded, because I have a tape of it when I was 15. That's how I sounded. So when you move in there and you sound like that, you get made fun of, stared at, whispered about, and it was really miserable. It was uncomfortable because it was almost like they'd never seen a new student from out of town. And in fact, a couple of the teachers told me, said, you know, it's highly unusual for us to have a new student. Nobody moved to Waterloo. They just didn't, and nobody apparently moved out. So I didn't know anybody, and everybody else, they all knew each other. So it was weird. But you know, it's no more weird, I guess, than any kid who's an Army kid, an Air Force kid. You have to move and change schools a lot. The only difference was I was almost like an oddity, like a circus freak to them because of the way I talked.
How'd you get rid of the twang?
Well, when I got out of high school, I tried to go to college. Was thrown out twice. I was kicked out of, at the time it was called Belleville Junior College. Now it's Belleville Area College, a two-year community college.
Okay.
And I tried to go to SIU Edwardsville. And during that time when I was suspended, probation, suspension, I get to SIU Edwardsville, and the mistake I had made was I had been studying to be an optometrist. Because I don't know what else to do. And if you tell your parents you're going to be any kind of doctor or attorney, that makes them happy. You can't live your life for other people. So I made the mistake of studying all the prerequisite courses to get into optometry college. But while I was there, there was a guy that I met, and he said, have you ever been in the communications building? And I said, no. He said, they're building a radio station. Come on, I'll show you. So he took me in there, and I don't know if this makes me any different than anybody else, but when I was a teenager, I was fascinated by radio. I loved radio. I tried to visualize what the studio looked like and how the commercials were played, and how come when they played a record, when I played it, it was, and then it would kick in. When they play, hear the Beatles, boom, and there's the song. And how do they do that? How do they get past all those grooves? Fascinating, but it fascinates lots of people. That doesn't mean anything. So I get to SIU Edwardsville. He shows me the studio, and he took me downstairs, and I just thought there were turntables and tape decks, and he said, go ahead, turn on the microphone. It's that switch right there. So I turned it on, and in that, you know, horrible voice, I said something like, there's some records in there. I said, hey, here's Elvis. And then I hit the record, and I thought, this has got to be the greatest way in the world to make a living. It's like being paid to have people over to come over to listen to your record collection. So I changed direction, and instead of chemistry and physics and the stuff I couldn't even understand, I signed up for a couple of broadcast courses and speech courses. Now, I don't think they did me any good because I wasn't there long enough, and I wasn't meant to be a student, but it introduced me to a whole different way of making a living. Not to be on the air. That was never, ever my goal. My goal was to write commercials or do character voices for commercials. That's what I thought. Because, you know, if you talk like that, maybe you could get every commercial came along where they needed a hick, you get the work. Well, how many of those commercials are there? You starve to death. But I know that. So I took a class, and it was called Speech Something. It wasn't a speech therapy class. It was a more of a public speaking class. And the first day in class, the teacher got up. I don't remember his name. I wish I did. And he said, I'm going to make this easy. It's the first day. I'm going to cut you loose early, but here's what's going to happen. You come back tomorrow, and I want everybody here to read 60 seconds of anything you want to read. I don't care if it's the phone book, the Bible, dictionary, just newspaper, just 60 seconds. Get up. Let us hear you speak. My turn came, and I actually took a phone book, and I just started Alexander, Andrews. I started going through reading. Thank you. And then when the class was over and everybody filed out, he looked at me. He said, could I see you for a second? I said, sure. He said, why are you in this class? And I said, well, a friend of mine took me down to see the radio station, and I loved it. I'd like, there's some kind of job in there for me at radio. He said, you're not thinking about going on the air, I hope, are you? And I said, well, I don't know. He said, well, unless you're hoping for some sort of job being a hillbilly or like a hick, you got a lot of work to do. And he said, I'll help you get started. And I don't even remember this guy's name, but he said, you talk through your nose. He said, the words just kind of fall out of your nose. He said, you have to learn to exhale and not sound. And then he wrote some words down, and he said, I'm going to go into the, they had a, it was like kind of like a library. You, instead of a book, you checked out and rented a booth, a soundproof booth. And then it was a tape recorder and a microphone and headphones. And you check out a tape, a reel of tape, and you put it on. And for an hour, it was yours. And you'd sit in there and do whatever you wanted, talk, sing. He said, I'll record some sentences that I think include all the words you're really butchering. And you need to listen and then repeat it like 1,000 times until it sounds more like me. And that's what I did. I'd go in there like every day, and I'd check out an hour in the booth, and I'd listen to him. And then I would, and it was lots of WH words, where, and what. And I just did that over and over and over. And it takes a long time. If you're from Texas or Tennessee or Mississippi, it takes a long time to get rid of it. And I'm still not completely free of it, and that's okay. But it was so severe that, I would never. By the way, this radio thing is still an accident. Even after I did that and I worked on it, my goal was never, ever to be on the air. I didn't know what it was, except that I liked the radio business. And then I learned that the commercials that I really liked, that were really entertaining and clever, Coca-Cola's commercials, McDonald's, whatever. Those weren't done at the radio station. I'd never heard of an ad agency. I didn't know what that was. But when I heard that, I thought, maybe that's where I should work, at an ad agency. And I could be part of creating the commercials that the radio stations run. They don't produce them. The ones they produce are, and still to this day, they sound local. And they sound like no budget. And they send a guy in the booth and, here, read this. So once I figured that out, my ultimate goal at some point became get a job in an ad agency, and I did. And then what I actually was doing until I was 30 was writing and producing commercials, slogans, jingles, and I've probably done 2,000 commercials where I was just the voice of somebody. Honey, I'm home, you know, or hey, look at this great sale at Famous Bar. Famous Bar, for you young people, was a big department store. but it was that stuff. It was just guy at home, dad talking to his kids, an occasional character, an old man or a kid. And I got all kinds of that stuff. But still never, ever thought I should have a radio show. At a point, I realized, and mainly from the reaction of other people and the fact that I kept getting rehired, that I was maybe just creative enough to make a living coming up with ideas, writing commercials. And so I wrote lots of commercials, and I did lots of voices, never, ever thinking I'll get a radio show. And then, am I doing this the way you want? Because change my direction if you want me to, because I should get started. I can't stop. And I just take it as I remember it. But if you at any point want to, you know, derail me and go, wait a minute, talk more about this, just feel free.
I think when the guest has a good time, the listeners are having a good time. Now, with all these characters and all these things we're talking about,
right?
I got to ask, where did Grady come from?
In 1971, I got married. 1972... I had to go into basic training for the Army. I'd only been married 7 months. So that took me away from here and took me down to Fort Jackson, South Carolina. And while I was there, I called my wife, still basically newlyweds, and I said, I like it down here. And I was going to be out of basic training in about 8 weeks. I said, let's just move down here. So we did. Now, the problem was, when you're young, I don't know what it is. It's like things that would scare me now didn't scare me. Like, uh-oh, I'm out of work and I have no money. Motivation, desperation is a great motivator. It really is. When you're hungry and starving, if you have half a brain, you'll figure it out. If you have to go chop wood or whatever you have to do. So I get out of basic. We live in a little trailer in a trailer park. Not a nice mobile home, a trailer. I mean the kind people make fun of, trailer trash, trailer park. No job, no money. So I started, so you asked where Grady came from, but I have to give you this backstory or it's not a story. So I interviewed, my goodness, I don't know how many radio stations around Columbia, South Carolina, within 100 miles, because I had done some work at WRTH, which ironically was 59 or 590. That was the first place I ever worked, was this very frequency.
It all comes full circle.
It does. But I wrote liner cards for the people on the air because I was not good enough to be on the air. So I wrote their little card. Don't forget, tomorrow night at 7 o'clock, it's the VFW Hall, chicken dinner, $5.95. I wrote that stuff. So I'm looking for a job, and there's a job opening that I saw in an ad for news director at WYCL in York, South Carolina. Well, I was in Columbia, 65 miles away. So I called the owner, and I said, and I tried my best to hide the accent, but remember, I'm in South Carolina. It's not a big deal. And I said, yeah, I understand you have an opening for a news director. And he said, yeah. I gave him my name, and I said, you know, I've worked at WRTH in St. Louis. And he said, oh, St. Louis. Like, that's a big market to him. He's in York, South Carolina. He said, you have large market experience. I said, yes, I do. And he said, well, it's a news director that I need. You do news? And I remember, I was brought up in a really strict Southern Protestant, too strict, home. You don't lie. And he said, do you have news experience? And my answer to him was, I went, do I have news experience? I just asked the question back to him. And he said, well, come on in. I'd like to meet you. So I drove 65 miles. I met Curtis Sigmund was his name. And he said, this is my program director, Richard Irwin. He's Richard's going to take you into the production room, set up a reel of tape, roll it. He'll leave, and I want you to read. He just ripped off some news off the teletype. And he said, just read whatever they printed out here. And sometimes when you're desperate and you're afraid, you freeze. You just lock up. You're so frightened. And I couldn't read it. I hyperventilated. I couldn't get my breath. And so I rewound it. I took it off and I took it into Mr. Sigmund. And I said, if you listen to this, you will never hire me. I wouldn't hire me. Please don't listen to it. I said, just do me a favor. Let me start Monday. Now, I'm asking to start as the news director. I've never done a newscast. The guy's never heard me. I said, please, I cannot perform under this kind of pressure. He said, well, what about the pressure of going on the air Monday morning? I said, I'll figure it out. And to his credit, I guess there was just something about me he liked. He said, okay, let's do it. And I said, can I come in all this weekend and look at the newsroom control? Because you had to run your own board.
Get acclimated.
Yeah, I just want to see where the cart machines are. And he said, of course. He said, that's good that you want to come in early. I said, I don't want to be paid for that. I just want to be ready. Monday morning, the pay was $125 a week. You had access to the WICL mobile news van, which was nothing but a van with call letters on it and a fake whip antenna hooked to nothing. It was just a van, but it made us look like we had a mobile news unit. And 6 o'clock came, and they had a big... Good morning, this is WICL News, and they had an echo. It was great. I read that newscast and didn't make one mistake, and he called me in his office right after the news was over, like 6:10, and he said... He said, can I tell you something? He said, I have never hired anybody, certainly not in the news, who came in here and did the first newscast flawlessly without one mistake. Well done. And I just thought, whew. He said, what did we agree to pay you? Which is a trick question. He knew what he was paying me. And I said, $125 a week. He said, well, you can forget that. 1:30. And I call my wife and I said, you're not going to believe this. I said, I've been here a day and I got a raise. 1:30. So we have $20 a month more than we thought we'd have. And I was ecstatic, like winning the lottery. And I was there for 10 months until I chose to leave, because I realized that in a little town in South Carolina, unless you're in the textile business, unless you own a textile mill or textile factory, you're not ever going to make a living. Not in radio. 1:30 was probably 80% of all I would ever make till I was 60 years old.
My first gig was in Frankfort, Indiana.
Okay.
And what I was horrible at was the city council and the town council were the same people.
Oh, did you have to go to the meetings?
Yeah, I had to go to the meetings.
Oh, there's nothing worse. There is nothing. I did too. And I just remember thinking, why am I here? I hated it, but I had to act like a news director. So I was there till I decided to leave, and I decided to leave because, I don't know, I thought I can do better than 1:30 a week. I don't know where, but it's not going to be here. It's not going to be in this little hick town. So I left and came back to St. Louis for a job that actually fell apart in 6 weeks. The guy lied to me. He was on the verge of bankruptcy. And when I moved, quit my job, my wife quit her job. To celebrate, we bought a brand new car, a Volkswagen Beetle. And I get back here, and 6 weeks later, the job's gone. No car, no jobs, either one of us. Just signed a lease up in North County off Lilac and 270, Raintree Apartments for a year. I got a year's lease, a new car, no job, no savings, nothing. And what I said before about being desperate, I had no clue what I was going to do, but I still had this ad agency thing. Now, I had had a little time on the radio as a news guy. I'm sorry, you asked about Grady. While I was there doing the news.
In South Carolina.
Yes. One morning, Every morning at 8 o'clock, I'd go next door. There was a motel next door. And I'd go get for me and for Richard. Richard was the morning man. He was great. He could have been in New York City. He was so good. The owners would make egg sandwiches for me and for Richard every morning. I'd go over and take my $3 or whatever and bring us over. I mean, this is nothing, little hick town. It's right next to a motel, and I'd bring us sandwiches and coffee. And one morning, as he's introducing, I think it was Elton John, Crocodile Rock, he swiveled in the chair, bumped me, and the coffee spilled on him, and he screamed on the air. And he said, and he had one of those voices, ladies and gentlemen, he said, I'm so sorry. Is this embarrassing? I didn't mean to scream on the air. He said, but it's not my fault. He said, we have a guy here who's kind of a gopher, and he's making this up. He said he's an errand runner, and he's clumsy, and he spilled coffee on me, and I'm not happy about it. He says, I don't even know your name. What's your name? And I said, I don't even know what we're doing here. And then I realized, hey, we're in the middle of an improvisational some sort of bit. And I said, well, my name is, I took my horrible voice and made it three times worse. I said, my name is Grady. And he said, well, Grady, you owe me and the listeners an apology. I'm a professional broadcaster, and I don't scream on the air. And I said, well, Mr. Irwin, I said, I am sorry. It was an accident. I didn't mean to do it. It's just an accident. And I mean letters, no email, letters poured in, ripping this guy apart. How dare you tear into that poor errand runner? And they hated him for that.
Ooh.
So after the mail had come in a few days later, he came on one morning, and he said, well, he said, you folks have put me in my place. I guess I was a little hard on Grady. I brought Grady back in today to apologize to him on the air. And he said, Grady, I'm sorry. I said, that's okay. You're only human. You were mad. I don't blame you. I spilled hot coffee on your crouch. And that's how it started. Every morning, he'd bring Grady in. And I have always been a pretty good joke teller, so I'd tell a joke. And Grady had, I don't know, 8 minutes maybe, and off he'd go. And we'd have sounds of a vacuum cleaner. Grady vacuumed. He went, got egg sandwiches. He opened the records when they came from the record labels. Grady just kind of did everything. But he was kind of a pitiful, like you'd almost picture a little, just a, you felt bad for him. But he was oblivious to the fact that he was clumsy and maybe not the brightest. And everybody loved. When I left there, in my basement somewhere, I still have a petition signed by the grade school students in York, South Carolina, begging Grady not to leave, because I went on the air and announced I'd be leaving town and moving, and coincidentally, so would Grady. Now, a lot of people figured that out. And I mean, when you see the teachers and the principal and all these students saying, Grady, don't go. They loved this guy because he was just, he wasn't anybody important. He was funny, just very likable.
Moving back to St. Louis, we're married. You had mentioned that you had gotten married in 72.
One, 71. Moved away in 72.
How'd you propose?
I don't remember. It wasn't a big deal. I think I just said, it's time we got married. Let's get married. We know we're going to do it eventually. Let's just get married. There was no ring. There was no ring for 7 years. She didn't have an engagement ring until 7 years after we were married. There was no honeymoon.
That's pressure. What that ring needs to look like if it's taken 7 years to get to
her. But not for her.
Good for her.
It didn't matter. And I told her, I said, I have nothing. I said, I can't even get you a ring. She said, I don't care. She didn't care. So no honeymoon. We didn't leave town for 5 years. So, because we couldn't. Again, we lived in another trailer park over right where O'Fallon becomes Fairview Heights over in Illinois. We lived in a trailer, a rented trailer, $90 a month with furniture and a washer and dryer, and barely squeaked by. But because she didn't care about that, which is something I really appreciated, the fact that it wasn't about a ring to show her girlfriends. And I think about it now, I'm sure it was awkward for her, because girls, ooh, look, I'm engaged. She didn't have anything to show. And she'd say, I'm engaged. I'm sure her girlfriend said, where's the ring? And I don't know what she said. I guess she just said, well, we don't have it yet. Well, we didn't have it for 7 years. And then there was a second ring, and then the third one, which is the one she has now, which is, you talk about from nothing to this unbelievable ring, but it took 25 years to get the ring she has now. So that's how Grady started, as an accident by spilling coffee on somebody's lap. And he said, "What's your name?" And I made up a name. And one day he said, "Grady, I think a lot of people would like to know," this is after he apologized, "a little bit more about you. What's your last name?" And as soon as he asked me, I thought, I don't know my last name. And I said, "Grit. Grady Grit." I don't know why, because grits are Southern, and I don't know, the word grit came into my head. So that's how Grady was born. And Grady went on to make me a pretty good hunk of money, because I did a bunch of commercials as Grady.
I remember them.
Yeah. And they were fun. They were fun. And it was the same pathetic character. He couldn't remember to get the name right. He said things that didn't make sense. Like I did a car dealer commercial one day, and the straight guy, who was generally only one of a couple of people, John Larrabee, probably did most of the, he worked at Y98 for a long, long time. He probably did most of it because he was so good at it. I remember one day we're doing a car dealer commercial, but I'm doing it with the dealer. And I said, there's something I don't understand. And he said, "What's that, Grady?" And I said, "These trucks you got this one and that one, and all on the back they say 4x4. Why don't you just say 15? That was Grady. He didn't even have his math right. "Just call them 15 trucks." And the guy went, "What?" And he goes, "Yeah, 4x4, 15. That stuff, just simple stuff. And he'd get the dealer's name wrong. Every time he'd get it wrong, even after he'd been corrected. The point of that was to make people remember the name. If you have an excuse to repeat it, they'll remember it.
How did you come up with Ed Etorial?
Robert Hyland was the GM at KMOX. And he did the station editorials at KMOX, and they were boring and pompous. And now, CBS Regional Vice President, General Manager of KMOX, Robert Hyland. And he'd come on and go, "You know, in St. Louis, Forest Park has the..." And they're always city council-like and boring. So when I was at KSD working with Ron Morgan, I came up with Ed Etorial. It was a takeoff on Bob Hyland.
Thank you, Ron. And they were just ridiculous. I do things like, "This station firmly believes that murdering another human being is wrong." Well, of course, everybody. And they were that ridiculous. And it absolutely went.
And again, you go by mail. And when the general manager says,
"What mail? What mail?"
Yeah, postal. Yeah. And when the general manager says, "Wow, we've never gotten this kind of mail before about anything," and then I knew there's something to add. So in the same building, this is mid-80s, there's KSD FM 93.7, and there's KUSA 550 AM. KUSA, I think, was 15th in the market, couldn't buy an audience. AM Country, and you had WIL, and then you had Kix 104, which was another FM. Well, what are you going to listen to if you want country music? One of the two FM stations or AM? So you're sort of a little bit of a problem there when it comes to competing, unless, and this is when I found out, that unless whatever it is you have on the air is so much better than what they have, they won't care. They'll go wherever they have to go to hear what they want to hear. You know, if Rush Limbaugh is on an AM station, and that's where you have to listen to him, and you love Rush Limbaugh, then that's where you'll go. So there was a woman who ran both stations, and she called me in her office one day, and she said, "Look, this editorial thing is on fire." Ed ran for president. I actually went out and did appearances with Secret Service agents. They were actually just big guys in suits with talking into their cuffs and sunglasses, but it looked legit. She said, "You know that our country station is dying. We can't even, we're irrelevant. You got WIL kicking our butts and now this other." She said, can you think of anything you could do on the AM station to just help us?" And I said, "No." She said, "What about editorial?" I said, "You don't want to move editorial to a," she said, "Well, then something like that, something where you have a character, and but the name sort of says who you are, like Ed Etorial, he's going to." So I went home, and she said, we want to do this right away. And I said, she said, Monday. This was Friday. She said, "Monday morning, go down the hall to the guys who are doing the show on the country station, and I'll tell them you're coming. do it, whatever. So I went home, and Sunday night I came up with Frank O'Pinion, which is like editorial. I call one guy who's a friend of mine to this day because he was very creative. I said, what do you think about this, Frank O'Pinion? He burst out laughing. He said, I love it. That was it. I went into Lee Sherwood's show. We had met. We didn't know each other. And I said, did they tell you? This was during the 8 o'clock news. I said, did they tell you I was coming in? He said, yeah, what are we doing? I said, I don't know. Just introduce me as Frank O'Pinion, vice president in charge of commentary. Just do that. He said, okay. And then what? And I said, I'll tell a joke. And when I hit the punchline, you just hit a rim shot. We're out. Boom. Back to your program. I go back down the hall to the FM station. I was in there maybe 8 minutes, 10 at the most. And from the first day, here's the deal. Everybody likes a good story or a good joke. They just do. When I say everybody, I guess there's somebody out there who doesn't like a good joke. There's something wrong with those people. So every normal person likes to laugh, and they like a great story and a great joke, but it has to be told right. So from the first joke I told, and I wish I could remember what the first one was, but I don't. Again, here came the mail, and it was all addressed to Frank O'Pinion at KUSA. Bigger than editorial. So I go down the hall into Merrill Hansen's office. She ran the station. I said, I don't want to be on the FM station anymore. I want to stay all morning on the AM. And she said, no, it'll cripple the FM. Ed is established. I said, but you don't understand. I said, this country audience, I could tell from the mail, this has more potential than, that's Ron Morgan's show, okay? And he had a big ego. No offense, Ron, rest in peace. But he did. Lee didn't. Lee was thrilled. Lee Sherwood was thrilled to see me come in because I was hopefully going to help keep this ship from sinking. They were desperate. And I mean, it worked within a year, maybe slightly more than a year. They went from 15th to 2nd, which is tough to do. We were beaten only by KMOX. And we had a killer morning show. It was a blast. It's to this day, it's the best radio I've ever been part of, and that's because of the people I was in the room with. Because they weren't jealous. They weren't fighting me. There was no ego clash. They wanted me in there, and they loved the fact that I had chosen to go with them. It took 6 months to convince her to move me. She wouldn't do it for 6 months, and I just kept on her, and I said, you're making a mistake.
Are you ending shows then with You've Got a Friend in Me?
No, that didn't start till, I don't know when it started. I think it started at Kix in the late 80s, early 90s, I think. Not at KUSA. I don't remember anything about what we did or what music we played or how we opened it. I don't. I just remember that Lee Sherwood was one of the smartest people I ever worked with, and sometimes you get credit for things you don't deserve credit for. Like every day, still today, I see ladies get in here, and the ladies laugh, and they come in. There's a sound of a zipper, and I tell a joke. What the heck does that even mean? There's a story behind it, but that was Lee's idea. Lee's idea was, if you've ever been in any public building and you see that little thing, it says, in case of emergency, break glass, and you pull the fire alarm. Lee said, we ought to have an emergency joke box. Like when everything is going south, I'll play glass breaking, and we'll act like you reach in and pull out a joke and it saves the show. It's brilliant. That's how, and it went from that to ladies come in and a zipper instead of glass breaking. Don't ask me how that ever happened, but it did. But that was Lee's idea. So I don't deserve credit for that. I deserve credit for not tossing it out just because that didn't work there anymore and for keeping it alive and making it better. But it was his idea. Lee's the guy who used to say, when any woman would call, because he was a ladies' man, this guy was a good-looking guy, he dressed well, he'd ask a woman who'd call in, how old are you? And no matter what she said, he goes, that's my favorite age. He was so smooth. So I just stole that. I do it. It's still funny. I don't care if she's 80 or 18. My favorite age. So it's about knowing what to throw out and knowing what to keep, what works, what doesn't work. Most people don't know that, or they rely on other people, focus groups, consultants. I don't ever. My gut tells me when something works or doesn't work, and the audience, they'll tell you.
a lot of people in this part of town, dream job is KMOX.
Right.
I read you actually turned it down.
Three times.
Uno's supposed to do it? Three times.
Three times, right.
Gut call?
Sorry?
Gut call? Just knew that it wasn't you, wasn't for you?
Well, I didn't care for Bob Hyland at all. He was a manipulative monster. Sorry. He was. And he was a control freak. And I don't want to work for somebody everybody's scared of. They were petrified of him. He's very powerful. And he called all the shots, and he told you when to inhale and exhale. And I also didn't like the way it wasn't just control. It was beyond that. And that scared me a little bit. When I turned him down, the last time I turned him down, he turned on me because he proceeded to call me, say things about me I didn't appreciate, because when you said no to Bob Hyland, in his mind, you were crazy, because who wouldn't want to work at KMOX? And this would have been on the air. Well, I didn't, because I didn't want to work for him. And I'm in his office. When I was in his office 5 days in a row, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, 5 days in a row, I met with him. And I guess about Wednesday or Thursday, he said, I want you to go over to Jack Carney's house. He said, you know who Jack is? I said, I actually know him, because we'd done a couple of commercials together. Now, well, so he called Jack right there in front of me and says, I'm sending him. He told him, send this guy over. I think there's something here. I want to know what you think. So he says, here, he gave me the address over on Lindell. And he says, Jack's expecting you. Well, right there, that bothered me, that he can just pick a phone, disrupt Jack Carney's day. And this is Jack Carney, but he still was the boss. So I go over, and we had a fantastic full afternoon. And here's how it started. I went up to the door, and Jack came to the door without his hairpiece. And he looked at my head and pointed his. I said, okay. He says, already, we got something. He says, now I remember you, because we had worked together. He said, nice haircut. I said, you too. And he's still standing at the door, hadn't invited me in. He said, so why really do you think you're here? And I said, well, I think I'm here because your boss, Bob Hyland, wants to know if you think I'm funny. And if you think I'm funny, that's all the blessing that I need to start working at KMOX as your sidekick. And then when you retire, I take over your show. I said, that's my take on it. He said, well, that's what I think this is too. He said, so are you funny? And I said, well, that's not for me to decide. He said, no. Are you funny? Yes or no? And I said, well, if I have to pick one, I'll go with yes. He goes, okay, we're done. You're funny. Now come on in and we can actually relax and enjoy ourselves. Pressure's off. So we went in and spent a fantastic 4 hours. But in that 4 hours, he did proceed to tell me this. He said, you know, I can tell you right now, this job's yours if you want it. Yes, you'll come in, work with me. And then when I retire, I said, when's that going to be? He said, well, I think about it every week. And then Friday comes and I get my check. And I go, okay, one more week. And then I get that check. And I go, well, he said, they're big checks. And they were. And he said, but here's what you need to know. And he proceeds to tell me about Hyland. And he said, you don't sneeze. You don't blink. You don't go to the bathroom without his okay. He approves everything. He said, there's no vacation without his approval. And you may not get a vacation 1 year because he just couldn't find a way to make it work. He said, so you need to know that. He controls everything. And if you can deal with that, he said, there are only two people in this building who have any leeway at all, who aren't completely under his thumb, his rule, and that's me and Jack Buck. He said, everybody else, I kind of feel bad for him. He said, but even with us, he goes crazy when I want to go on vacation. Who do we get into filling for you? Oh, yeah. He said, it's just, you need to know what you're getting into. And I appreciated that. And I said, so when... You don't know when you'll retire. He said, I don't. He said, but it's not far down the road. He said, I'm getting ready. I turn it down, and Hyland on the phone says to me, well, you obviously are a man without much integrity. And I said, what did you say to me? He said, you have a lack of integrity. I said, how dare you? I said, you don't even know me. You don't know me. If you did, you'd never say that, Bob. And I said, this is where I start calling you Bob, because I now have no respect for you. Everybody calls you Mr. Hyland, not me. Not after you said what you said to me. And I said, I am so glad now that I made the decision not to work for you, now that I see who you really are, that because somebody doesn't bow down and kneel and thank you 100 times for giving them a chance at KMOX, you attack their character. You did it to the wrong guy, because I'm not that guy. I'm proud of my integrity, credibility, so you don't know me, and you need to learn not to judge people, certainly label them, when you don't even know them. And I hung up. Within 5 minutes, I get a call from a guy named Tim Dorsey, who was Hyland's right-hand man.
Mm-hmm. I know Tim.
He said, my name is Tim Dorsey, and I work KMOX. I'm Mr. Hyland's whatever the title was. And he said, he is furious. I heard him on the phone with you, and he slammed down the phone. He says, you call that guy, and you get him in here and tell him he starts Monday. And I said, well, Tim, you're going to have to disappoint him and tell him you weren't able to do that. I don't know you, but I think I know him, and I'm not working for him. You call me when he's dead. That's when you call me. Or when he's completely out of the radio business. Then you call me. And that was it. And a year later, Bob Hyland, call me at home. Call me home in the morning. My wife says, I think it's Bob Hyland. He said, it's a Mr. Hyland. I said, nah, it wouldn't be him. I pick up the phone. There he is.
Hey, Bob Hyland.
I said, Bob, what can I do for you? And he said,
well, I think it's time that we revisited you coming to KMOX.
I said, no, you must not have much of a memory. A year ago, you told me I didn't have any integrity. I haven't forgotten that, and I told you I'm not going to work for you. Apparently, you forgot that. And he said, oh, that's water under the bridge. I said, well, maybe for you. You don't attack my character and then have it just go away. No thanks. And I hung up, and that was it. It was the last time I ever talked to him.
So we brought up Tim Dorsey.
Right.
And let's fast forward to KTRS.
Right.
I was there the day you started. I was selling. That station was a circus. All the things that they had tried to be.
Well, they tried to be KMOX.
And it wasn't working.
Didn't work.
It was failing horribly. They bring you in, and it's
which he did not want to do.
Okay.
He was absolutely against it. He called me. And the name, I thought, Tim Dorsey. And I thought, shoot, that's a guy, KMOX. And he told me about they'd acquired the station, and they brought Bill and Wendy over and whatever, Debbie and Diana, all that KMOX stuff. And he said he wanted to meet me at Schneidhorst. So I go to Schneidhorst. I'd never met him. I go to Schneidhorst, and it's Tim and Jerry Clinton and I think two of the board members. And we had a long discussion, and Tim said, I got to tell you something. You are not what I want on this station. He said, I want more of like a KMOX. He says, you're not it. I said, then why am I here? He said, because I've asked at least 40 people whether I should do this or not, and they all said yes. He said, so I got to go with, they can't all be wrong. Maybe I'm wrong, so let's talk. And so we talked, and one of those board members said, would you be willing to sort of change what you do and make it more like KMOX? And I said, no. And I'll tell you why. I'm not interested in boring people. And I'm also not smart enough to be Bob Hardy or some political. And I'm not that smart. I'm a joke teller, storyteller. No, KMOX is boring. And I said, I'm not going to do that. And that's not the answer he wanted. So they turned to Jerry Clinton. Did you know Jerry?
I didn't know him well.
If ever there was a guy who you always knew exactly where you stood, Jerry was a no BS, tell it like it is guy. And they said, Jerry, what do you think? And Jerry said, I don't curse, okay? And I'm not going to do it here. But Jerry said, well, I don't know an effing thing about radio, but I think this guy does. And Jerry got up and left. And I think that sort of, it didn't hurt. And so we did the deal for 5 years and renewed it for another five, and I was there 20 years.
People who know your deal, typically no salary, take 90, 95% of the commissions.
Right.
Help that to pay your people. Here's what I learned.
95% of the commission. It's of the ad revenue
correct.
For the sponsors that I speak for.
Of all of them.
Right.
Correct.
Right.
because I would get 5% for like bandanas.
Right.
And I would handle the account.
Right.
A to Z used computers.
Right.
I'd get 5%.
Right.
But this is what I learned that I didn't know about you until you came over to KTRS. And this is meant to be a huge compliment. You were the first person who not only wanted and liked to do two live spots. Because right. remember back in the day, it was beneath the broadcasters to do live spots. And you embraced it.
Yeah, well, they were there to play music right. or whatever.
Or do the news.
Right.
So two things right off the bat, John, Frank.
Yeah.
One, you reveled in doing the live spots. And the other thing you did that I don't think anybody still does well is you intertwined your sales, your sponsor.
With a story.
So, you know, I'm going over to Johnny Londoff, but I got to go grab some lunch at Bandanas. And
I got to get my loan at First Community Credit Union before I go get the car.
And not one sponsor ever complained that their spot
no.
was mentioning other, because they got mentions
exactly.
in other people's last spots.
It was a reciprocal thing.
Right.
They would get that benefit in another commercial. You can't do that all the time, but yeah, when I could, I would do that. I also wouldn't ever read commercials because they sound red. Now through Saturday, save like never before. Nobody talks like that. I don't talk like that. Yeah, it's our biggest sale of the year. Nah. They're having a sale. It's a big sale. Yeah.
You know, the other thing I learned from you, we'd go on sales calls.
Right.
And you would say, I'm paraphrasing, David, if they bring up their spiritual background, their love of God within right. the first 5 minutes.
The red flag.
This ain't happening.
Right.
And dead on. I can think of three times. And those three people were in the news 3 or 4 years later.
I'm telling you, man, when somebody has to justify their honesty with God or something, it's almost a warning. Now, that's not to say that it always backfires on you or that they're crooked, but I'm a lot more suspicious of a guy that goes, you know, we're a faith-based company. I'm more suspicious of that guy than I am a guy who never mentions anything like that. I just am, because I think they use it. I don't think that's what religion or faith is supposed to be for. Use it as a sales tool. So, yeah, I still believe that. It's still true.
Last good Frank opinion story. You had the first radio show ever broadcast over the internet.
I didn't know that.
In St. Louis.
I didn't know that.
A to Z used computers.
Yeah.
Eddie Rich, we hooked up that laptop. Remember days of modem and
yeah.
all that stuff hooking up? It did sound great, but we tried it.
Yeah. I didn't know that. Yeah, that's the first time I've ever heard that.
Looking back at KTRS, more good than bad, hopefully.
Yes. Oh, sure.
Just the ending bad?
Ending was bad, yeah.
I remember the morning show when you first came on, AM and the PM, who came up with that?
I did. I own that. It's actually trademarked. Nice. AM and the PM belongs to me. Frank Opinion belongs to me. Yard Sale belongs to me. I own that. Yet, the other station I just came from still runs a yard sale. They've had a cease and desist. They ignored it. Here's the problem. I could sue them and get what? Get them to stop? Okay. They'll just change the name. And I spent a lot of money suing them. It's not worth it. They know it's mine. They just defiantly chose to keep it anyway after I left. That's okay. That's okay. It was a big deal to me until it wasn't. And I talked to an attorney. He said, yes, you absolutely can sue him. You own that. He said, but then what? How much is that going to cost? Will it last, take a year, 2 years, tens of thousands of dollars? And in the end, they're told, stop it. Okay, they stop and they change it to the garage sale. And what have I actually accomplished? So it's not a big deal anymore.
20 years at KTRS, you had a few different lineups, and still the radium stayed the same.
Yeah, what's interesting was that whole KMOX idea didn't fly. Like you said, that audience didn't follow those people, Kevin Horrigan, Bill and Wendy. They accepted them on KMOX, but they didn't accept them outside of KMOX. You know, Bill and Wendy came and went two or three times. They were in, fired, rehired, fired. I think they kept thinking, well, let's try to get it. It wasn't meant to be. You can only have one KMOX. You can only have one of lots of things. You can't clone something like that, even if you take the people. It's sort of like KMOX, for many years was, if you just attach those call letters to anything, success. Anybody you put on the air, if the audience felt they were accepted by Jack Carney and Bob Hardy, and well, if they're on good enough to be on KMOX, I like them. And that's sort of the way it went. You could be a mediocre to okay talent, but you're on Camo X. So in the minds of the listeners, you must be really good. Yeah, not necessarily, because then you leave and nobody follows you. So it didn't work. Oh my God, Kevin Horrigan, Debbie and Diana, Bill and Wendy, Dave Schumacher. I mean, they had 10 or 12 names that they thought, it's kind of like when they got the Cardinals. They thought, we'll get the Cardinals. We'll own this town. No, I told Tim Dorsey, I said, here's what's going to happen. You're now the Channel 11 of radio. He said, what do you mean? I said, well, Cardinals were on Channel 11 for a while, and people watched the game because they had to go there to watch it. But when the game was over, they were still Channel 11, and people didn't watch. And that's what's going to happen here. We're going to get listeners for the ball game because they have to. They're forced to. But that's not going to be the reason they listen to this station outside the ball game. It has to win them over on its own merits. And I was right. I was right. That didn't do anything for that station, except we didn't make any money.
Your clients loved you. You had a waiting list, and it wasn't a fake waiting list. It was
a waiting list of I think, 10 advertisers at one time.
Yeah. You're getting three times what pretty much anybody else is getting live spot-wise. Doesn't have anything to do with ratings. Is this a true story? Were you on the air one time, and the station was having a hard time getting advertisers to pay?
Yes. True story.
Tell me this
story. I know this story.
Tell me this story.
At Kix 104, I walked down. The lady's name was Carol, and she was the bookkeeper. And I overheard Carol on the phone and begging for somebody to get current. They were like 120 days out. And she just, when she got off the call, I could just see she was just at the end of her rope. And I said, Carol, what's going on? She said, these people that won't pay their bills. She said, she showed me, like, they're all people at least 90 days out. We ran their commercials, they don't pay their bill. So I went on the air, and what people didn't catch was that in about 10 days, it was going to be April 1st. So I said, a week from Monday, let's say it's a Wednesday. I said, 1 week from this coming Monday, I'm going to come on here and name the names of all the companies who think it's okay to not pay their bills.
And there were some big names.
Oh, and I said, you're going to be shocked at some of these names. I said, it's not right. You already got what you paid for, yet here 3-4 months later, you don't want to pay. And I said, I'm doing this for Carol because I watch Carol trying to beg some of you to pay your bill. Pay your bill, or a week from Monday, I'm going to call you out and I'm going to tell all these people the names of your businesses. A week from Monday came, I went on the air and I said, April Fools, but thank you for all the checks. The checks poured in. I mean, these people were, Carol said, oh my goodness, she said, this was brilliant. Thank you. And they got money because I would never do that. They didn't actually know me well enough to know that from a business standpoint, that would have been the kiss of death, man. If I'd gone on the air and said, well, Anheuser-Busch and Deerbergs, and you don't like to pay your bills, I'd never be able to work again. And what's funny is that the GM or nobody there, I don't think they either thought, well, he's not really going to do that, or they just didn't hear it because they never said a word. Because if they had heard it, they would have called me in and said, are you kidding me? Are you going to do it? And I would have said, of course not. I'm scaring them. They'll pay their bills. And they did.
That's a great story.
It's a true story.
For somebody who's been in radio as long as you have, how have you avoided consolidation? I can't think of anybody I know who's been in this business for more than 20 years and did not have to put up with consolidation.
When you say consolidation,
multiple stations owned by the same company.
Well, I have. When I was at KUSA, KSD, that was owned by Gannett. Gannett had a few hundred stations.
But in St. Louis, just the two?
Well,
I don't know.
No. In St. Louis, I worked for Gannett. Gannett was bought by Easy Communications, which was huge. So now I work for Easy. So I did work by default for big conglomerates, but I never let them treat me like just somebody else in one of their markets. I wouldn't do that. I'll give you an example. Most everybody in the radio business, when you sign a contract, I don't have one now, I don't need one, but when I did, they always had this non-compete thing in there. And the last contract I signed with Gannett, everything was perfect, except I get to the part where it says, at the end of this 5 years, you sit out for 6 months and you don't work in this market. And I said, I'm not going to do that. If I honor the term of the, if I go the distance and fulfill all my obligations, in 5 years, you cut me loose. I shouldn't have to be punished for going the distance. That doesn't make sense to me. And I remember Merrill said, well, you don't have a choice. It's a Gannett thing. And every single on-air person who has a contract signs a no-compete. I said, well, I'm not. We were down to like 2 days before I was supposed to start there again. And I said, Merrill, I'm not kidding. I'm not doing it. It's not a federal law. It's your own Gannett little thing. And they can strike it from my contract just as quickly as they put it in. And I mean, like 3 days before, they pulled it. They took it out. But I'm serious. I said, if you want to pay, you want to pay me 6 months salary to stay off for 6 months after I finish my, fine. But I'm not just going to sit out with no job. I can do it. So I didn't avoid them, but I never let them play that game, that corporate game with me. You know, Easy was the president of Easy Communication was a guy named Alan Box. And when they bought Gannett, Karen Carroll became my boss by default. Her boss was Alan Box. He flies in and Karen says, Alan wants to meet you. Now, this guy just acquired a whole bunch of radio stations. Two of them were KSD AM and FM, yet he wants to talk to me. He picked just two or three key people. I think he just wanted to make them feel comfortable now that they're with another company they didn't intend to be with. And he said to me in her office, he said, well, he says, Frank, he says, you have no idea how long we've wanted you on board at Easy Communications. And I said, yeah, I do. You've never wanted me on board. You got me because you bought a station. He says, oh, no, we've been after you for quite some time. And I said, how did you do that? Because I never got a call from you. How exactly? And now Karen's looking at me like, oh, my goodness, don't do this. I said, Alan, how exactly did you try to hire me?
Because, Frank, if you're nothing, you're about first impression.
Yeah. And he said, well, you know, we always want. I said, oh, you wanted me here, but you never tried to hire me. You got me now because I came with the station. And I could tell she just thought, oh, I wish I'd never invited you in here because you just don't talk that way to this guy. But I do because it's just BS. Well, we've wanted you on board for a long time. Don't give me that. Don't give me that. So, yeah, I didn't avoid them. But my choice would always be to deal directly with the people who own the station. It just is. It's simpler.
After KTRS, did you think about hanging it up?
No, no, no. That won't be my decision. That'll be the business, the industry's decision. That'll be radio's decision, not mine. I can do this till I drop dead.
Still having fun.
Yeah, and it's easy. Why would you quit this? It's 12 hours a week. It's as easy as talking on the phone or sitting here talking to you. Why would you quit that? I'll quit it if there's no money in it. If there's no money, I'm not doing it for fun. Some people do. A lot of people have podcasts. They don't make any money.
Right.
They podcast. They like having a podcast. That's fine. It's a nice thing. If you like it and enjoy it, I enjoy it, but I'm not going to do it for nothing. I'm just not. It's like I'm not doing commercials for $20.
Right.
A lot of people do. More power to them. It's great. Every live spot you do will give you $20. Now, every live spot I do, you give me $500. I'm not going to do it. That's it. Tim Dorsey said something I'll never forget when we put the deal together, and I said to him, he said, I cannot afford your show. You have five people on your show. At the time, I did. I said, you don't have to worry about that. It won't cost you anything. And he said, what? I said, I'll take care of all of that. And just before we signed, he said, I want to make sure you understand what you're agreeing to. He said, this is extremely risky. He said, if you can't get what you want for these spots and sell as many as you think you can sell, he said, you may end up making nothing or next to nothing. I said, I'm not the least bit worried about that. I said, don't worry about that. I'll be fine. And I was more than fine to the point that within 2 or 3 months, it was obvious that he had no idea how much money.
Did he try to change your deal?
He did.
Totally, Tim.
It wasn't him so much as the board.
And there were like 19 people on the board.
Well, I don't remember, but after the 5 years,
right,
when I was making the kind of money nobody makes in one market in radio, he told me that the board wasn't sure if they wanted to renew my contract as it stood without changing it. And I said, can I talk to the board? So he arranged for me to go before the board. And I said, I understand that you might not want to renew my contract. I wonder why. It's a free show. And a guy named Paul Lorenzini, who was on the board, old guy, he piped in. He goes, well, I'll tell you why. He says, I've seen the books and GD this and GD that. And there's no way that you should be doing as well as you're doing. And the station is struggling to make a profit. And I said, well, what's your name? And he didn't like that. He didn't like that I didn't know who he was. He said, I'm Paul Lorenzini, and I'm an investor and a board member. And I said, well, let me tell you something, Paul. Your problem is not with me. Your problem is with him. And I pointed at him. I said, if this station is not successful in making money, it's not my fault. It's not my fault. And I'm not going to be punished for that. If I'm doing well, it should indicate to you that, hey, there's a potential here and there's an audience. Maybe this station could do better. You own every commercial on this station except the three that I do an hour. They're all yours. If you're not making money on them, something's wrong, and it's not me. No, I'm not changing my deal. My deal still costs you nothing. Whether I make $15,000 a year or $2 million a year shouldn't matter. It should make you realize there's money to be made here. We need to do our part differently. And they re-signed it because I said, I'm not changing it. Same thing happened to Kix when I was at Kix. My goodness, that was like 87 to 93. And I'm making like $400,000 or $500,000 a year. So it was unbelievable. And the GM says, I want to have lunch with you at, where do we have lunch? I forgot. I would always remember where we had lunch. I just forgot it. Wherever it was, he brings the books, the actual billing, and he brings it all and lays it on the table. I said, what is this? He says, I just want to show you something. He said, and he goes to the bottom line. Here's total net. Here's what we make after all expenses at the station. Here's what you make. He said, we need to redo your deal. And I said, no. I said, Bill, you and I made this. I didn't make this by myself. You and I made this deal together. But now all of a sudden, because I'm handling my part better than you're handling your part, I need to give you some of what I'm, no, not going to do it. He says, so that's it. You're just not going to allow us to, no. I said, run the clock out on it and don't rehire me. I'm not doing that. And I just wouldn't do it. You know, the funny thing is, many times I've been scared to death and unsure, sometimes if you just, it's amazing if you stand your ground and you do it in a way that makes a point. And my point was, if you're not doing as well as you should be at the station, don't blame it on the most popular guy you have on the air. That doesn't even make sense, especially when you're not even paying him. It's not coming from you.
You don't seem to me to be a person who's very stressed. Seems to me like you got it under control.
I'm the most stressed person you'll ever meet.
I missed on that.
No, you did miss it. I'm extremely stressed. My whole life I've been worried and nervous and stressed. But for some reason, when I'm in a meeting and when I'm under fire, I don't know. I've just always had this ability. If I know I'm right, they can tell that I know I'm right. And the reaction is maybe he knows he's right because he is. And maybe we're wrong. But, oh, man, I've been scared to death. I've been scared a lot. But I think that's over. I'm old and...
You're a grandpa.
Nobody can hurt me. What are you going to do? I mean, not hire me? Okay. I don't work anymore? Okay. I don't want that. I don't. Paul Harvey worked till he was, what, 90 or something?
Forever.
Because he's a storyteller, and unless you lose your mind or your ability to talk, you will always have those stories. And every day, you get new stories. Every day. You know? Regis just died. Regis
88.
Philbin, 88. Well, I've been listening to what people have been doing. I got a different take on it. Oh, who wants to be a millionaire? Regis to Kathy Lee. But very few people actually know when Regis had a show in St. Louis or the details of it. He did a live show, a talk show from St. Louis.
Yeah.
He did it for, 4 years. He flew in once a month, taped 8 or 9 shows, and the ratings were higher in the first 2 or 3 years than Saturday Night Live. Because Saturday Night Live, when it started, it was on 5, he was on 4. They struggled. That first year or two of Saturday Night Live, it was not, they struggled because it was controversial, but Regis was killing it with his St. Louis show. And that's what I'd like to talk about, because it's fascinating to me that a guy who has family money, he's a rich guy, he didn't need to work his butt off. While he was doing the St. Louis show, he was hosting a morning show in L.A. He would fly out of here at midnight and be there in time to do a morning show live after he'd taped it. It was unbelievable. So, yeah, that, how did we get on that? I don't even know.
Just talking.
Yeah, I'm just talking.
All right, getting ready to wrap it up. We're going to do a St. Louis 7. The last question probably is too long of an answer to put in the St. Louis 7, but ever think about how and why with St. Louis you had such a connection and kept that connection?
The connection is not with St. Louis. It's with people. It's with regular people. I don't have a college degree. I don't know any of the big words Bob Costas knows. He's much smarter than I am. His vocabulary is much more extensive than mine. The success is because I am a very average, regular person who lived in trailers, who grew up very poor. I relate to regular people far more than I relate to rich people. I don't relate to rich people. So it's not about St. Louis. What I do, telling a story, telling a joke, would work in Seattle. It would work in Fort Smith, Arkansas. I don't know about New York City. That's a weird place. That might be tough. But I think even there are enough people that surely there's a percentage of those people that's significant enough to support a show who may be in New York City, but they're not real New Yorkers. They're there because they had to go there. They would understand what I do. What I do is unconsciously just who I am, and who I am is a guy who actually really does appreciate the guys in the hot weather that have to do what I don't have to do. I don't even really have to work, and haven't for a long time. I did for a while, move furniture. I popped corn on the street corner, cut grass. I did all that. But for most of my adult life, what I do, I haven't had to work. It's not work. It's just talking. It's just telling a story. And that's it. So connected with St. Louis. Yeah. I think I would have done it in Memphis, Kansas City, anywhere where there are enough just regular people. People where, you know, I listen to guys like Dennis Miller, Bob Costas, and I just go, wow, I don't know. Mm-hmm. There are 10 words you just used that I don't even know what they mean. That would be great. But when you do that, now you're talking over the heads of a lot of people. I can't do that. I can never talk over your head. I'll never use a word you don't know the meaning of. I don't know those words. But my grammar's pretty good, and I think I understand regular people. And that's what most of this country's made up of. It's not PhD people. It's not people with CEOs. It's just regular people, you know? So that's what connected, I think.
Thanks for sitting down. I enjoyed
it. It went fast, and that means it was good if it went by fast. And it did. Thank you.
Enjoy. All right.
That was quick. That was a fast hour, I thought. Thank you.
And there is another one for the books. Frank, man, had a good time. Appreciate it. John, Tim, thanks for setting it up. This Thursday, we're going to have an episode with Dick Hewlett. If you don't know what Clayton Studios was or is, you're going to want to tune into that. Also, if you want to hear a little bit about what St. Louis radio was like in the mid-60s and 70s, we were a top 10 market, and we were kicking some booty. Going to have a good time. Hopefully, you join us on Thursday. So, as we do, thanks for your time this time. Till next time, so long.